The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. From enormous, juicy fast food burgers to perfectly plated enchiladas, we have all seen food advertisements on TV and menus and in billboards that look too good to be true. And that, of course, is because they are. Angelina Chapin is blogs editor at The Huffington Post and a contributor to The Guardian, where she recently wrote the article, WD-40 and Microwave Tampons, Secrets of Food Photography Revealed. And Angelina, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So I think we can't go any further without explaining that title.
Right.
So, microwave tampons? What?
Yeah. So obviously we pull out the most interesting bits for that headline, and those certainly qualify as them. WD-40 is something that one of the food stylists who does a lot of Mexican cuisine told me about. So she sort of sprays the meats and the enchiladas, kind of the outside of any kind of food she's working on, to give it a brown, juicy, glistening sheen. And then the tampons are actually to create steam. So, for example, if you have a bowl of pasta that has that nice kind of mountain fog coming up over it, that's because a tampon has been wet with water, microwaved, and then embedded somewhere either in or beside the pasta.
I'm not sure I want to know these things.
I know. It's a very weird image, that one.
Well, so you spoke with a number of food stylists for this piece.
Yes.
What does like an average food shoot entail?
Well, it's quite long, so it kind of reminded me of maybe being on a film set or something, where they actually start early in the morning and it kind of goes for 10 or 12 hours.
What?
Yeah, so there's, and you know, they might not be shooting just one ad, it could be a series of ads. There's a couple of moving parts, right? So there's the photographer, and then there's the stylist who are working together, and then they've got all their assistants and aides running around to get everything prepared. But the stylist would have a kit that he or she brings to set and materials ready depending on what commercial or ad they're shooting for. And then they sort of just get to work setting the food up. Often they have to cook. Often they have to chop or make a dish from scratch. A big part of it is improvisation. So there's sort of two parts to why they use food that isn't real. One is that, you know, mashed potatoes might just look better as a milkshake in an ad because of it's an easier material to work with and they can style it in the exact way. But another reason is because real ice cream could melt, or they could be working with a steak that has freezer burn on it and doesn't look good, so they have to bring in something else quick. So it's kind of an issue of always thinking on their feet, which is why one stylist told me all of a sudden her client wanted coffee and they didn't have that on set, and they're under extreme time pressure. They're paying big dollars for this, so she just grabbed some soy sauce and watered it down.
You mentioned mashed potatoes, which is another sort of go-to trick that you mentioned. How do they use mashed potatoes besides as a shake?
Yeah, in all sorts of ways, but the main thing is for stuffing. So you think mashed potatoes is actually the most essential thing in a stylist's toolkit because they're easy to make, they use instant mashed potatoes, and they're easy to mold. So you take an enchilada, for example, rather than have to cook up the vegetables, get all the meat going, and have it be the perfect shape, they just kind of use this filling that's very malleable. So it can also be used as the base of salads. You just kind of stick, so there won't actually be that much lettuce or spinach, whatever you're working with, underneath. It's all plumped up by mashed potatoes.
Well, so it's just the surface.
Yes, it's just the surface, and that's a good way to sort of sum up a lot of these tricks. It's that below the surface, the fake stuff is going on. So, for example, you take the turkeys that are bloody inside because they're not going to cook them the full amount of time, which is a huge pain. So, yeah, the turkeys will be basically raw, but they look good on the outside.
Well, are there any rules, I mean, either officially or even ethically, that need to be followed for food shoots? Or can food stylists pretty much use anything?
Well, they can't use anything. I mean, truth in advertising applies. So, for example, if they're doing a shoot for Breyers ice cream, they have to use the actual ice cream. But if there's toppings, for example, a cherry, maybe they would use a cherry tomato because they happen to have that on hand. So as long as the core product that's being sold is the real deal. Anything else goes. And then, of course, those are for commercial shoots, but for more editorial shoots in magazines, anything goes for sure, because that's just more about making something look good. And because you're not pushing a product, there's not the same ethical standards to adhere to.
How about drinks? You mentioned coffee. A substitute for that would be soy sauce. But how about alcohol? You know, those beautiful looking drinks with the glistening glasses, precipitation beating down the sides.
Yeah, of course. So they don't ever use real alcohol, unless, of course, it's being advertised. But if it's just sort of your stock photo of a martini, there's not going to be any vodka in that, because that would be a horrible waste. So the main thing they pay attention to are those details you mentioned, sort of the condensation, the drip, the frost. Some interesting techniques are to use spray-on deodorant to frost the beer glass. For coffee, in terms of getting sort of bubbles around the rim, they use pipe soap. And then to salt a margarita rim, they put Vaseline so it's extra durable. Things like that.
How easily we are fooled. I mean, do you feel like a sucker after finding out some of these tricks?
I mean, I think I just feel a little grossed out, to be honest, especially the one about glue as in cereal for the milk.
Oh.
I can't look at cereal photos anymore. So I just kind of feel it changes things that are supposed to look delicious. When you sort of get under the skin and know the secrets, all of a sudden these ads have the opposite effect, where you actually want to throw up because you're imagining ingesting glue.
You mean like Elmer's white glue, that kind of thing?
Elmer's white glue, or another popular milk substitute is a hair product from the 70s or 80s, a men's hair cream called Wild Root, and it looks like sunscreen.
Well, I was reading some of the comments about your article, and it was very interesting to see how some people looked at these tactics, you know, either as fraud, misrepresentation, but others not surprised at all and would even prefer to have food ads doctored to look perfect.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess that's a really personal thing. We don't seem to come down on it as hard as we do, for example, photoshopping women's bodies in magazines. I mean, I think most people think that's a bad practice that sort of sends a wrong message and creates all these societal issues. But with food, I think because it is food and because we all see food in real life, I mean, we know we don't usually buy something because it looks delicious in an ad, most of us. I mean, we all go to restaurants, we all go to grocery stores. We have a pretty good idea of what things look like. So I don't think there's the same sense of feeling duped.
Well, food photography is really a big part of social media, especially on Instagram. So I'm wondering if any of these tactics might start being used outside of the professional settings.
That's a good question, which I hadn't thought about it, but you know, I think a lot of the social media food photography is in the moment. The whole thing is that it's fast. You're at a restaurant, you shoot your food before you eat it, and then, you know, the plate's gone. So I don't know if people are really going to start carrying around, you know, lipstick in their purse to kind of put on a strawberry that doesn't look red enough. I would be surprised unless there's sort of a paid component. For the average person, I don't know how practical it is.
Well, Angelina, I think I'm really grateful that you exposed this to us, but I thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Angelina Chapin, she's blogs editor at The Huffington Post and a contributor to The Guardian, where you'll find her article detailing the secrets of food photography. There are some fantastic pictures of fake food that looks delicious. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Gluten-free versus gluten-fine, olive oil or coconut oil for cooking, Mediterranean or paleo. Figuring out a healthy diet is like stepping into the Wild West with shots being fired from every direction. Line up the studies and you'll often find competing results. Wine and coffee, for example, both have been shown to lower and to increase your risk of getting cancer. So if nutrition is a science, why is it so hard to figure out what is good for you and what's bad? Well, the data geeks at 538 have an answer. Christy Ashwanden is 538's lead science writer, and she recently wrote about why nutrition science is so hard to pin down, and in the process discovered some dubious correlations of her own. Christy, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So one of the big problems you outline in your article is pretty basic. It is hard to know what people are eating and how much. So how do researchers usually track food habits?
Sure. The normal way that food habits are tracked in research is with something called a food frequency questionnaire, or FFQ. This is the most common way that people try to figure out what people are eating. And what it is a survey that asks people, there can be different timelines, but a common one would be, over the last 6 months, how often did you eat potato chips, say? And when you ate potato chips, you know, how much did you eat and how often? And so, you know, based on people's answers to things like this, that's how you get correlations. Like in our study, we found that potato chip eating was correlated with a high math score on the SAT.
You tried to keep one of these FFQs of your own. Do you think you kept an accurate count?
It was really difficult. I would say that I don't trust my answers. After taking the FFQ, it sort of spits out an assessment of your diet, what you're eating, how many calories, what sorts of nutrients you're getting, and whatnot. And the FFQ told me that my three top sources of calories were cheese, full fat, mm-hmm. both red and white wine, and oatmeal. But things that you eat less often, then the accuracy is going to really go down. You know, I know that most mornings I have a bowl of oatmeal, and so I'm pretty sure about that. But when you ask me about something like cantaloupe or lemonade or bananas, things that I eat sometimes but not a lot, you know, I found myself often as I was taking the test thinking, well, I don't really know, and really feeling like I was guessing.
Well, I guess one of the things I got from your article was that coming up with portion size or measurements is really a tricky business.
It really is. And I think, you know, I've talked in the past with researchers who study obesity and are trying to help people lose weight. And one of the problems is it's really hard for people to measure serving sizes. You know, it's easy if you're at home and maybe you're using a scale or you're eating something that comes in sort of a discrete packet or something like that. But otherwise, it can be really difficult. One of the questions on the food frequency questionnaire that we took asked, how often do you eat cheese? And, you know, how many slices do you eat? And a lot of the cheese that it turned out that we were eating doesn't really come in slices.
Right.
Or does, you know, we think of it more in chunks. And, you know, how big is a slice? I don't know.
I can understand that. But using this food frequency questionnaire, you did some experimenting to see how easy it is to find these links between individual foods and some possible health factors, like you mentioned potato chips and being good at math. What are some of the other correlations you found, and how do you come up with them?
Yeah, so what we did is we recruited some readers to take the FFQ as well. The FFQ, after someone takes it, spits out this enormous set of data, different variables that you can then look at. And so we paired that with a little quiz that my colleague Walt Hickey sort of came up with. And we asked them about all sorts of things, what religion they were, whether they had a dog or a cat, if they'd had a weird rash in the last year, whether the film Crash deserved to win Best Picture. So some sort of silly things. And so the food frequency questionnaire itself produced over 1,000 variables that we could then test against the 26 different characteristics, like, you know, what you thought of the movie Crash, that we could compare them against. And so what it did was almost ensured that we would come up with some spurious correlations. And in fact, in our calculations, we found that we should expect at least 1,300 false positives. So it was extremely easy to find things that weren't real.
So just out of curiosity, what were the correlations with the movie Crash?
People who drank lemonade believed that Crash deserved to win Best Picture, but iced tea lovers didn't like Crash.
Also see correlations between eating raw tomatoes and Judaism.
I think my favorite one is that people who trim the fat from their steaks were more likely to be atheists than the people that, you know, ate the fat that God had provided for them.
And this is from the 538 blog. I mean, isn't this all about what data can reveal about us? The aggregator that accurately predicted the 2008 presidential election? How on earth did you come up with these?
Yeah, we just sort of use the same sort of techniques that are used in these nutrition studies. So what they do is, let's say you're interested in cancer and you want to know, are there foods that might be correlated with cancer? Recently, earlier last year, there were some studies that came out looking at meat consumption and cancer, for instance. And so they give a bunch of people the food frequency questionnaires and then sort of sort them into how much meat they're eating and how often, et cetera. And then they look at, you know, who gets cancer and is cancer more common in the people that are eating more meat versus the ones that are eating less. And so this is really sort of the technique that's used. And the problem is that, you know, first of all, correlation is not causation. So very frequently when these studies are reported in the media, you'll see a headline like foods that fight cancer or you know, something like that, that's implying causation. Mm-hmm. These studies just cannot prove causation. They can only suggest.
So eating table salt does not really connect that strongly with the positive relationship with an internet service provider, as you found it.
Probably not. And I mean, if you think about it for a second, you know, let's say it's completely possible that that correlation is real. That's another important thing to understand, that it may be that these things are correlated, but it doesn't mean that they're causal. So if you don't like your internet or cable provider, you know, putting more salt on your food probably isn't going to help, you know, but it may be that people who eat more salt, you know, tend to watch more TV and the salt's coming from, you know, salty snacks that they're eating while watching television and, you know, et cetera. So there are reasons that something might be correlated, which do not then translate into actionable things that people can do in the way that it's so often presented.
Well, Christy, do you think we're so desperate to know what kind of effect food has on our bodies that on some level we may know these studies offer a simplistic picture, but maybe choose to believe them anyway?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think most reasonable people understand that, you know, eating more of a particular fruit isn't going to allow them to live forever, right? Right. You know, if eating some particular food really could have your chance of getting cancer, we would all be doing it and it would be a huge public health good. But one of the problems is when they present these results, they're so often presented as relative risks instead of absolute risks. And so that really seems to inflate the effects. But I think fundamentally what we're seeing here is that, you know, scary things happen to people. You get sick, people that were previously healthy develop cancer. And, you know, when these sorts of things happen, the first impulse that we have is to look for a way to protect ourselves or a reason why that's not going to happen to us. And food is one thing that we can actually control as opposed to all these other factors. So I think it's just a natural human reaction to want to control this one thing. And it's sort of a way of trying to get a sense of agency over, you know, impending death, which we can't stop, right?
Christy Ashwinden is lead science writer at 538. You can find a link to read her fantastic article, You Can't Trust What You Read About Nutrition. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. And now for a little untold history lesson. Well, you may have heard of Thomas Edison and Alexander Graham Bell. What about Rufus Porter? Casey Herman of Salt Radio has the story of a great inventor, largely absent from the history books, and the small but dedicated group of enthusiasts, which thinks he deserves more credit.
In the mid-1800s, Ferdinand Zeppelin, the man whose last name became a word for airship, was a teenager. The Wright brothers had not even been born, and this commentary appeared in the newspaper, the Philadelphia Bulletin.
Every man of sense is, or ought to be, aware of the impossibility of steering a balloon or any other aerial machine. Yet it seems there has been found in New York a fellow who was knave or fool enough to advertise a flying machine.
The man behind this flying machine was named Rufus Porter. His formal schooling ended when he was only 12. But during his life, he invented over 100 ingenious, useful mechanical things. Yet today, Porter has no grand monuments or elementary schools named after him. Just a small museum in his childhood hometown of Bridgeton, Maine.
So this is the museum.
So I'm in the Rufus Porter Museum in Bridgeton, and there's no one here except for me and Samantha.
My name is Samantha Scarf, and I am the associate director at the Rufus Porter Museum.
Samantha agreed to give me a private tour in April because the museum is closed in the winter. It's mostly devoted to Porter's life as a folk artist. He painted indoor murals with scenes of coastline, trees, and rural life.
We have a smaller mural in here.
Samantha is among a small, dedicated group of Rufus Porter enthusiasts who think he deserves broader recognition.
He only painted for about 20 years. He spent a lot more of his life as a scientist and inventor than an artist. He was a brilliant man, ahead of his time, but he's so unknown.
So how is it that Porter didn't end up among the great American inventors?
That's a good question, and I think it's because Rufus was not a self-promoter. He was, in fact, a terrible businessman.
Samantha suggested I call this man, Royd Knuckles. He's extensively researched Porter's life, and he gives talks at the museum.
Many inventors will go into production, gain some fame and maybe fortune through that. But Rufus never did that. He would invent something, come up with an idea, and then move on to something else. He never made any money from any of them.
Probably the best example of this is one of Porter's early inventions.
In 1826, Rufus Porter actually designed and had built a repeating rifle that incorporated a revolving cylinder. Rufus Porter sold that design to Samuel Colt for $100.
As in the man who made a fortune manufacturing the Colt revolver, the gun that won the West.
You know, a lot of people, as far as science and mechanics are involved, are touched by Rufus Porter, and they don't even know it, because Rufus Porter was the founder and original publisher of Scientific American magazine.
Porter sold Scientific American after only 10 months for $800. Today, it is the oldest continually published magazine in the United States. And then there's the one big idea that Porter pursued for most of his life.
He wanted aviation to be practical, so he began pursuing a dream of powered flight. He called this his aeroport or aerial locomotive.
Porter published his first design for a hydrogen airship in 1834. It looked like what we today would think of as a blimp. He built working models and gave demonstrations in Boston, Washington, and New York. People came, paid admission even, to see if his 22-foot cigar-shaped flying machine would actually fly. Newspapers that had made fun of him changed their tune.
Mr. Porter's flying machine did all that it promised on Wednesday evening. It rose above the audience and went round the hall, and it satisfied some of its greatest opponents that it could navigate the air.
Porter was looking for investors to build a giant version of the airship to carry passengers. He published a pamphlet detailing the design and showed his math on buoyancy, weight, and cost of construction. He even thought about safety, proposing that each passenger on the airship have a parachute in case of emergency. Samantha Scarf.
I mean, Porter was talking about not just flight, but commercial flight, selling tickets to people to fly way before it happened.
It was indeed an idea ahead of its time. Here's Royd again.
He proposed that his aeroport be 800 feet long. In 1849, he proposed being able to fly from New York to California in 3 days. One of the things in his favor, he was able to use the gold rush as a marketing mechanism.
The gold rush. Land and sea routes to California took months and were risky and dangerous. A 3-day flight seemed far-fetched, but enticing. Porter sold advance tickets for the first trip on his yet-to-be-built aeroport.
He got some takers and in 1849 began building in Hoboken, New Jersey.
Porter got well along in the construction, but in 1850, natural disaster struck. A tornado destroyed the almost-finished airship. It took Porter 2 years to raise enough money to try again. That attempt was even unluckier. They encountered problems with the materials. Vandals slashed the airship balloon, and another storm damaged it when it was nearing completion. The man who is in the history books for the first engine-powered flight is the Frenchman Henri Giffard. Giffard made his flight in 1852, 2 years after the unlucky tornado ruined Porter's chance. Giffard's airship was a very similar design, but he was independently wealthy, and he didn't have to worry about raising money for the attempt. He was awarded the French Legion of Honor, and today, he is one of 72 names inscribed on the Eiffel Tower in Paris. Porter's story shows how much of history, who we remember and who we don't, depends on chance. usually we only really remember the people who succeed. But what about the people like Porter who fail?
Yes, they do need to be remembered because they left an impact, whether their, machine worked or not.
Breakthroughs never happen on their own, without all the failures that come first.
He's an unsung hero, somebody who contributed that much. I think he deserves a huge amount of recognition, and if I could help do that, he'll never know, but I'll know.
Rufus Porter's advocates are working to get him and his inventions that recognition.
We're working to get Porter inducted into the Inventors Hall of Fame.
With a little luck, the luck that eluded Porter during his lifetime, they might succeed. For Salt Radio, I'm Casey Herman.
Unexpected stories and offbeat approaches to what's happening around the country and around the world. Those are just some of the reasons why you listen to NHPR. It is spring, and NHPR's Fund Drive is happening right now. Show your support by becoming a sustaining member.